We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Support for this podcast comes from U.S. Bank. U.S. Bank wants to know how you reward yourself, because they have cards that make every day more rewarding. Are you a points hoarder, cashback guru, low intro APR lover? With U.S. Bank, it's up to you, because they have the cards to fit your lifestyle. So earn more whether you're shopping at a gas station or grocery store, even while planning a staycation. Learn more at usbank.com/creditcard. U.S. Bank credit cards are issued by U.S. Bank National Association N.D. Some restrictions may apply. Member FDIC.
Welcome into the Week 9 NFL podcast. I am your host, John McKechnie, joined as always by Mario Puig here on the RotoWire NFL podcast here on Thursday, November 5th. We have a lot of games to get to. There's a lot of just kind of craziness going on around the league with COVID, with everything in between. So we got an interesting Week 9 coming up, and we're really faced with it right off the bat, Mario. We got the Packers facing off against the 49ers. The 49ers have had issues with COVID within their building. They've also had probably the worst injury luck of any team that I can remember of the last decade plus. I mean, it's just been unbelievable, like the toll that the injuries have taken on the 49ers. So we've seen a ton of line movement as a result, obviously, with George Kittle and Jimmy G being out. That's a huge factor there. This game opened up as the Packers 2.5-point favorites in this one. Now they're checking in at 7.5-point favorites on the road. These teams met around this time a year ago, and San Francisco absolutely shellacked them, and then they shellacked them again in the NFC Championship game. Don't expect that to happen. These are two teams going in very different directions right now, although the Packers do have some injury concerns of their own. So I'll just open the floor to you on your expectations for this game.
Well, yeah, the Packers have their own COVID situation too, so the whole game feels really difficult to pin down and parse out. And I guess as long as, in the Packers side, Aaron Rodgers, Devontae Adams, if they're out there, I guess particularly given with what the 49ers have on the shelf, maybe that's kind of enough for the Packers to be close enough to themselves, their general nature, even with their own shorthandedness. Like maybe Rodgers, Adams is enough, and, knock on wood, it seems like they'll be out there. It seems like Jair Alexander will be out there. So those three guys are kind of the Packers to me. And I know there's other players, but I think if you have that kind of star power in a game like this, where the 49ers, like, none of their star power is even theoretically available. Like, it would have been Kittle, it would have been Mostert, it would have been maybe Richard Sherman, who knows, Bosa, of course. So they're down. Those guys are out. They don't have Ayuk or Debo. So I don't I'm not particularly caught up on the Garoppolo part of it. I think he's just not any good, and I think Mullins can basically be as good as Garoppolo most of the time. So that's not the part that I care about. But Mullins throwing instead of to Ayuk, Samuel, and Kittle, and throwing to whatever Ross, Dwelly, Kendrick Bourne. I don't even know if Trent Taylor is going to be an option. Like, maybe they're going to have to go with I don't even remember. Is Mohamed Sanu still there? It's like stuff like that. So with that and then a bunch of backups on the defense out there, I don't know what the 49ers can reasonably be expected to do. I don't know how you really do your job in this sort of situation.
Yeah, I mean, it is such a mess. And like you said, you know, it's one thing for this 49ers offense when Garoppolo goes out. We've seen it before. You know, Nick Mullins or CJ Beathard can do some sort of, you know, imitation of what an NFL offense looks like. It doesn't last for very long, but on like a one game or two game sample, you know, they don't completely embarrass themselves. It doesn't go completely out the window. But again, that's underpinned by having legitimate stars like George Kittle or some of these, you know, pass catching threats, Debo Samuel and so on. I mean, I'm looking at their depth chart right now and we have it ordered with Trent Taylor number one. And then it's just red the rest of the way. Richie James is questionable. Debo Samuel, COVID. Brandon Ayuk, COVID. Kendrick Bourne, COVID. They got rid of Dante Pettis. Say again?
I didn't even notice the Bourne one before. So, yeah, that would be, I guess, Trent Taylor and Mohamed Sanu. Who's the third receiver then? Taylor, I guess?
It might have to be one of us. I don't know if they can get us out there in time, but... yeah, Sanu's...
Honestly, I don't understand how this isn't like liable to go south on an hour by hour basis. I guess we'll, you know, tell by the game starting, but like, how can they possibly have isolated these people when there's this number of them who were carrying the virus? I don't get it. And even on the Packers side, it's like if Aaron Jones is out, Jamal Williams and AJ Dillon have the COVID list, the COVID exposure. So I guess what is that guy's name? The Notre Dame back.
Dexter Williams.
Yeah, Dexter Williams is going to have to be like the star today, I guess.
Tonight's the night, and yeah. It'll happen again. Dexter Williams. Dexter Williams somehow back onto the fantasy radar for Thursday. I think that, you know, he's someone that if you're throwing together a showdown lineup, that sort of thing, he can be on the radar. You got to be really desperate and season long to be streaming him. But, you know, again,
if Jones is out, though,
yeah,
I think he becomes a flex play, honestly.
Really? I mean, I guess
Tyler Irvin can't get 20 carries or anything.
No, you definitely can't saddle him with that. Dexter Williams, you know, he's built for that. He's not going to give you a ton on a per carry basis, but I think that, you know, bottom line, he will see the enough volume to probably, like you said, hit that or be on the flex radar. When it comes to the Niners, let's talk about their running backs before we move on. So it looks like it's just going to be Jerick and Jamichael Hasty once again. Looks like Hasty's rushing over under prop sits at 63.5. We saw the Packers give up a lot on the ground a week ago, and we figure with the limitations to this Niners passing game, we could see the 49ers really go heavy on the ground here. So do you think that the Hasty McKinnon you know, combo can make some damage here?
Not really. I guess Hasty's probably going to get like 10, 12 carries at least, but I just think it's going to be more like 45 yards than 60, something like that. I guess I think we would specifically need Rodgers and Adams to not do well for Hasty to go over that number. He's not even really the Mostert type to get you like a long 50 yard carry to kind of make it happen. He's going to need 6, 7, 8 yard gains at a time. He's more quick and explosive than he is long speed anyway. He could be playing in a tough spot, too, with Mullins and that passing game being so bad. The Packers have pretty decent pass defense personnel, at least at certain points. They're very strong. And against an offense that's shorthanded in the passing game as the 49ers, I think the whole thing collapses for the 49ers offense here.
Yeah, they just don't have any sort of legitimate threat as far as the pass goes. So the Packers, who have been that run funnel type of defense, they can, you know, just kind of allocate more resources to stopping the run, and then it will all collapse, kind of like you said, for the rest of that offense. Let's get on over to our next game. We got the Chiefs going up against the Panthers. Chiefs 10.5-point favorites at home in this one. I think the biggest fantasy storyline for this one would be Christian McCaffrey trending towards his return, his first game since suffering that high ankle sprain back in Tampa Bay in week two. What can we expect from him in this matchup? Because we know that occasionally the Chiefs can also kind of concede the run a little bit in their own right.
Yeah, that system, at least given the results of Mike Davis, and if we believe Mike Davis, despite his great numbers this year, is still basically a replacement level runner, and that's certainly how I see it, then we should consider McCaffrey pretty much golden as far as the setup of the offense and his usage within it. And we can start to wonder then, like, will he also be better than Mike Davis was, which, A, he really doesn't need to be. Like, Davis was putting up huge numbers, at least in PPR scoring he was. But B, yes, we can expect Christian McCaffrey to be better than Mike Davis. So I don't know so much about the setup with the matchup with the defense or the game script or anything, but I also don't know whether the answers to any of those questions matter for McCaffrey. Like, if it's a blowout, he's probably playing for some reason. If it's competitive, then yeah, of course, he's probably the reason that it is competitive from the Panthers' side of it. So I think he's pretty high floor, high ceiling as far as the on paper stuff goes. It could really only be an aggravation of the injury, I think, that disrupts any of that.
Okay, hopefully we're far enough down the road here to where that won't be an issue, but I think Carolina would be pretty cautious with the running back they just gave a lot of money to. So
maybe, I'm just assuming they don't really care that much because they, I don't know, it's like you have to justify him by giving him that contract, you know, and Mike Davis isn't really like an asset, but I guess some risk of a committee is there. I would be surprised.
Yeah, definitely. As far as the passing game goes for Carolina, which of these guys can pose any threat to the Chiefs, or are the Chiefs kind of uniquely set up to really slow down that trio of Anderson, DJ Moore, and Curtis Samuel?
Well, the Panthers are, of course, free to change their game plan, but their game plan all year has been Robbie Anderson is the wide receiver one. Like, he gets the most viable targets, and then DJ Moore gets left with the most high difficulty outside targets, and Curtis Samuel only competes for the underneath in the slot targets. So that leaves like in Anderson's case, at least, that leaves like a range of possibilities. Like, they could choose to use him a little bit more in the slot, a little bit more in any particular part of the field based on matchup if they want. DJ Moore only has so much negotiating room as far as his usage. He'll always be outside, which isn't necessarily bad against the Chiefs because Tyrann Mathieu tends to be the slot corner, which would mostly be Curtis Samuel's problem. And I don't really like Samuel's usage in the offense. I don't really like the ways that they apply him. So when you add Mathieu to the equation, for me, that's enough to be kind of pessimistic about Samuel. Although with his kind of speed, the big play is always possible. It's just all else being equal, Mathieu is harder. Typical other option outside, Charvarius Ward, I think, is better suited to cover Robbie Anderson than Rashad Fenton is. Rashad Fenton's been getting a lot of good PFF grades, but he's, I think, ideally more of like a slot corner type. Like, he's short and he's adequate athletically, but he's not truly fast. So I think Anderson, DJ Moore, they can run away from a guy like him. Whereas Ward, he's like a 4.4 guy with a 40 vertical. So I think he mirrors Robbie Anderson pretty well, but they don't move those two corners. So if the Panthers want to move Anderson away from either one, they'll be able to do it. And the other thing, I guess, is like there could be quite a bit of garbage time in a game like this. Not necessarily, but if there is, then it's kind of like, well, then the Chiefs kind of go into a fake defense kind of mode anyway, and it doesn't really matter what the matchup is. So I think you can consider Anderson pretty high floor, not like high ceiling specifically, because I don't think the matchup will be favorable. Like, I think they'll have to, it might be like by the skin of their teeth kind of things if they do on offense for the Panthers have a good game. But the personnel is pretty good with the Chiefs, and I would say, I don't know, it's like any of those three guys are fast, they can make big plays, but it's just not going to be easy for any of them, especially.
Okay, I think that's a good way of framing it. On the other side of this game, what's the latest with this Kansas City backfield? Because, I mean, still dominating the snap share for the most part, but neither of them putting up giant numbers over these last couple of weeks since Le'Veon Bell joined the fray. We saw CEH the first week against Denver, 8 carries for 46 and a touchdown, added a 17-yard reception. This past week against the Jets, 6 for 21 and 3 catches for 10 yards. So not really a whole lot going on there. Do we kind of just expect both these guys to be like fringy fantasy options the rest of, I mean, like Edwards-Hilaire still has a ways to go before you're like benching him, but do you see a possibility or a trajectory where Bell starts to work in on the snap counts, and you know, if Edwards-Hilaire is doing that little with his touches as is, that this becomes a problem for just getting fantasy value out of either of these guys?
I think it could just be a situational thing. I don't really think it's possible that if I don't really think there's a scenario where Clyde Edwards-Hilaire just plays so poorly and Bell plays so well that Andy Reid changes his mind on who the two of them are. I think it's more like he knows who each of them are. You know, he knows what their limitations, their strengths might be, and he's probably not going to get caught up in like anecdotal events as far as his idea of these two guys go. But you might, I think, just kind of see a thing shake out where Clyde Edwards-Hilaire tends to play when they basically need to move the ball. And Le'Veon Bell maybe picks up just kind of course, the breather situations for Edwards-Hilaire, but then also kind of maybe the lower the stakes in the game, like the less interested they are in a 20-yard carry, basically, in a given play, the more likely Le'Veon Bell is to get that snap, I figure. So I kind of imagine like a 55-45 or a 60-40 kind of thing. And hopefully with guys like Darrell Williams getting completely subtracted from the equation, although that hasn't even happened yet either. So it's kind of unfortunate for especially the Edwards-Hilaire people who took him in the first round. Like, that stuff isn't happening. But you kind of have to keep him in as a flex play if you do have him.
Yeah. And again, to your Le'Veon Bell point, not since he sat out the 2018 season has he run for 20 yards in a single carry. He is over his last 276 rushing attempts. 3.3 like, yards per carry.
Even Adrian Peterson has one. That's pretty rough.
Woof. All right, let's move on over. I think this will be one of the more fun games of this weekend slate. A lot to get into on this one. Seattle going up against Buffalo. Really nice high over under in this one, sitting at 55. The Seahawks 3-point favorites on the road. That speaks to kind of how much the Bills have kind of slipped back to the pack over the last month or so. I mean, I think at the end of September, you could have said that they were one of the best teams, if not the best in the AFC. That's not the case anymore. Josh Allen over his last four games, just one game over 20 fantasy points. He's got a 4-4. So really a 1-1 touchdown to interception ratio, 6.6 yards per attempt. But so that's a pretty strong downward trajectory. But can a matchup against the Seahawks at home be something that gets him, you know, back on the right track, even for just a week?
Well, I don't know what the latest in the injury reports are for the Seahawks here. I'm going to pull that up here. The addition of Carlos Dunlap could be pretty significant. They're getting Rasheem Green back, I think, on the defensive line pretty soon. So the Seattle defense is going to improve up front, perhaps starting in this game. And certainly over these subsequent weeks, they'll get there, I'm sure. Looks like Shaquille Griffin might be out. If he's out, that's pretty big. Even if Shaquille Griffin and Quentin Dunbar are both out there at corner for the Seahawks, though, I really like this game for Josh Allen. I think the tempo urgency details are going to be especially in his favor with a team like with an offense like the Seahawks coming in. And there is, I guess, some risk that maybe the Seahawks offense just sort of has a little bit of an off day. I guess that's theoretically possible. They're on the road. It's a long distance. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the weather's going to be. Maybe it'll be stupid one way or another. Who knows? But I think the median range outcome here is the Seahawks keep rolling on offense, because you look at the Buffalo defense. There's some good pieces, certainly, but there's not necessarily any combination of pieces that's going to reliably stop the Seahawks offense as it's currently constructed. And as the Bills defense is currently constructed, there's definite weak spots to the kind of threats that the Seahawks can pose. And you look at a guy like Tre'Davious White. He's a corner who normally changes the complexion of the opposing offense, because he can remove, like, impede other top receivers enough to oftentimes make. But if he's going against Tyler Lockett, then DK Metcalf is going against someone who can't cover him. And if Tre'Davious White is on DK Metcalf, of course, no one can cover Lockett, whoever it is that's on him. And I don't think Tre'Davious White can cover DK Metcalf either. So I don't think it matters what the Buffalo defense does strategy wise. I think if they're going to get a, if they're going to force an off game from the Seattle offense, then I think it basically needs to be because McDermott came up with an incredible combination of stunts and blitzes that surprised Russell Wilson, and they just hit him before these receivers can get open. Because I think the receivers will get open if they have time to run the route. So I'm not particularly worried about McDermott having that good of a game plan. Like, to me, it's like a 1 out of 10 chance McDermott just completely catches by surprise Russell Wilson. But even if he does, it probably will only last about 2 quarters. And if they really have the incentive, the Seahawks offense can kind of create entire games worth of stats in a quarter and a half or whatever. So I think it's a good setup for Wilson, you know, every week basically going forward. Mm-hmm. And for this game, I actually really like Josh Allen, especially as like a tournament play in DFS, because his usage could go up. And particularly if Shaquille Griffin is out, then there should be a John Brown open, even if the Stephon Diggs is covered. But I don't think Diggs loses to anybody really either. Like, I think Quentin Dunbar is a really good corner, but I don't think he stops Diggs or anything. And whoever's on John Brown can't cover him.
Right. Exactly. So I think that, you know, rightfully so, there's a really high total in this one, and for good reason. I think both these offenses should be able to click. Interesting details there about the Seattle defense, you know, getting some resources back, but still it should be a good setup for both of these offenses. And I guess the last question for you from a fantasy perspective is what you can do about the Seattle backfield, because I mean, everyone is so banged up right now. We got Chris Carson questionable. We got Carlos Hyde out. DJ Dallas, really the only one that's not even on the injury report. Travis Homer, also questionable. So is this another week where DJ Dallas is on the radar?
I guess it's pending the Thursday practice report. But yeah, last week it seemed like Homer basically couldn't play. It was kind of like an emergency backup. And yet he was the only backup for DJ Dallas in that game. I don't think DJ Dallas is very good, and I don't think the results were very good in that game. But if you're on the field at any position, and especially running back on the Seahawks offense, you can score touchdowns, and he'll be involved in the passing game. Like, he'll always be he's the definite passing down guy if Chris Carson isn't active. So yeah, DJ Dallas could play 45 snaps again. And if you're playing 45 snaps in the Seahawks offense and you're a running back, it doesn't even really matter how bad you are.
No, it really doesn't. Not when the defense has to, you know, account for guys like Lockett and Metcalf. And I guess this is more just like a one-off question, but it's been, you know, bandied around on the timeline a bit this week. Do you think that DK Metcalf is the best receiver in football now?
He could be. I haven't really tried to figure out that question in a while, but
I don't know if there's anyone else I would rather have. I guess I don't know if it technically means he's the best or whatever, but if I'm like just picking a receiver to start my receiving core, I'm not going anywhere else but Metcalf, I don't think.
Yeah, that's fair. And I think there's an argument to make that even if you're not specifically thinking of usage as far as he specifically goes, the kinds of details that he brings to an offense are such helpful things for kind of like foundational traits of, you know, the space on the field and the things that opens up for everybody else on the field when you can credibly threaten the parts of the field that Metcalf does. It's like, that's pretty rare. And even if he's only giving you like 1,200 yards or something, maybe he's creating more room for other players that doesn't show up specifically there. So in other words, like, even if he's not as good of a route runner on like these intermediate routes, like even if he can't do Stephon Diggs kind of route, it's like maybe his overall effect is such that it's, you know, he can make everybody else better in a way that other receivers can't. So I wouldn't argue against it. If I was picking somebody else, I guess it might be AJ Brown. And AJ Brown, Julio Jones, I guess those are the guys that I'm looking at. I never believed Michael Thomas was one of the best receivers, or he's one of the best, but he's like a top 6-5 kind of guy to me. Beckham used to be there. He's too injured these days to really compete like that. And Julio's is still pretty much, obviously, time's going to come for him eventually.
Yeah, I think so too. I'm glad you brought up A.J. Brown. You know, we're big A.J. Brown guys, of course, as well. Very SEC biased here on this podcast. But anyway, we'll move on. Let's get on Broncos, Falcons. You think Drew Lock is startable this week potentially against this Falcons secondary?
Yeah. I mean, technically he was startable last week, even though it was, you know, up and down as a game and it barely came together at the last second. The Falcons, you know, they're just about the dumbest team. Them and the Cowboys, I guess, are just the most disgraceful teams aside from the Jets. We got like three of the five most disgraceful teams in NFL history all this year happening. So it's hard to stay with any conviction which one is the worst out of them. But it's bad, and their defense is bad. So it's one of those things. Like, I don't want to say Locke is especially good. I don't really think he is, but he keeps kind of he always stays in the right mindset to be competitive in a game. Like, he's not a Tannehill type who will fold if he gets like slapped up a bit. Like, he'll even if it's just because of you know, not knowing any better, it's like he kind of stays focused competitively because he always thinks he's got a shot. And that really paid off in a game like last week. In a game like this, the Falcons defense is so bad, and matchup by matchup, it's like Jerry Jeudy in the slot. That's a Jeudy advantage. KJ Hamler against whoever, Kendall Sheffield. I probably give Hamler the advantage. Tim Patrick on AJ Terrell. That's tough, but Tim Patrick's been playing really well this year. Noah Fant hopefully a little healthier in this one, so hopefully he can get better return for his targets. Seems like they didn't really feature Albert Okwuegbunam until late last week, but he's kind of the reason they won. So I'm wondering if they're maybe going to try to keep him more consistently involved, because he's been so good. And at this point, there's not much objective reason to say Noah Fant is definitely better. And at some point, if he keeps playing like he has been, that's going to creep into the minds of the Denver coaches. But in the meantime, it's like, just use both of them, especially in a setting like this.
I was going to say, yeah, why don't they just start using, you know, more two tight end sets? Because, I mean, that's where so much of their skill position talent is located right now. I mean, I
think it might make Jeudy worse. And that, don't get me wrong,
that is political.
I would put Jeudy outside and just say, like, you know, just do it. And, like, he'd probably be fine. It's just like, he's not going to have, in my opinion, like a Calvin Ridley scenario as an outside receiver. I feel like Judy's better in the slot, but with the way Okwuegbunam and Fant can collectively, they can threaten so much speed for so much mass. It's just, it's one of those things where you shouldn't spend so much time as a coach specifically thinking out, like, how are we going to use this? It's more like, just put that on the field and watch the defense kind of struggle with it, and then things will work itself out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that definitely makes sense. I think that I would love to see more of those two guys. I think they're both very good. I think you were definitely right in saying that Albert O was very underrated during the draft process, and he's got some really interesting upside to his game. So I would love to see him get more involved. Let's get over to the Atlanta side of this one. Looks like Calvin Ridley, speak of the devil, is day to day. Obviously, yeah. He suffered that injury against the Panthers in that rainy one last Thursday. So he gets a little bit of extra time to get himself ready, but don't know if he's going to be at 100% in this one. If he is limited or out, you know, how much does that sting this Atlanta passing attack? And you know, specifically, you know, how much does that hurt Matt Ryan's, like, you know, fantasy outlook for the week? Does he fall outside of the top 12?
I think it hurts quite a bit. I mean, Julio's awesome, but if you're talking about Vic Fangio going against this dirt cutter offense where it's just Julio on the field, and then the next best pass catcher is either Hayden Hurst or Russell Gage, and then the running game is led by Todd Gurley and Brian Hill, I think Fangio can find a way to deal with Julio in that case. I don't think you're hurting a Vic Fangio defense with any of these other pieces that we just identified. So I don't know. I'm not a better, and I'm probably bad at it if I tried, but it makes no sense to me that money is coming in on the Falcons in this game, that it went from 3.5 Falcons to 4 with the over-under going up by 3. Like, if you think the Broncos are going to score enough points such that the over-under goes up by 3 and the spread only goes up by a half a point, I think you're losing maybe by, like, a touchdown or something. because if the Broncos are scoring, then that means the Broncos offense is doing okay against this Atlanta defense. But the Denver defense is not going to just fold, especially if Ridley's out. But even if Ridley's in, I don't know. I just don't trust Fange. I don't trust Cutter to ever get his team to play up to their level of talent. And I always expect a Vic Fangio defense to play above its level of talent. So the Falcons defense, if it doesn't stop Drew Lock, then I think the Broncos win.
I like that call a lot. I think that, yeah, the coaching edge definitively on the Broncos side here, especially like the Broncos defense versus Falcons offense, especially, again, if the Falcons are at less than full strength as their skill position guys go on offense. Before we get over to our next game, we got a message from our friends over at PropSwap. Smart sports bettors always know where to find the best odds before placing a bet, and that's why smart bettors use PropSwap. You can always find the best odds on PropSwap because you're buying directly from other bettors like yourself. See a ticket you like, but think the price is too high? Submit a bid for a price you think is fair, then buy it. PropSwap sellers are always willing to negotiate, and we all know bookies never will. And for a limited time, our listeners can get up to $500 in bonus cash. Just use the promo code ROTO500. That's promo code ROTO500. And PropSwap will match your first deposit up to $500. Become a smarter sports bettor today. Go to PropSwap.com or download the PropSwap app. Got a message from our friends over at BetMGM. We know football is back, but did you know that new customers at BetMGM can still get a 100% deposit match up to $500? Simply sign up and make a deposit with the bonus code ROTOWIRE to take advantage of this offer. There's never been a better time to get in on the action at BetMGM with parlay bonus payouts, live betting, daily boosted odds, specials, and more. Don't let 1 minute of NFL action pass you by. Download the BetMGM app today or go to BetMGM.com and use bonus code ROTOWIRE to double your betting bankroll with a 100% deposit match up to $500. Must be 21 or older and physically located in Colorado, Indiana, New Jersey, Nevada, or West Virginia. Please gamble responsibly. If you have a gambling problem, call 1-800-522-4700 in Colorado and Nevada, or 1-800-GAMBLER in New Jersey and West Virginia, or 1-800-9-WITH-IT in Indiana. Promotional offer not available in Nevada. All right, Mario, let's get on over to our next game. We got the Ravens going up against the Colts. The Colts, they are at home. The Ravens, 2-point favorites coming off that tough loss against Pittsburgh this past Sunday. Turnovers really sunk them in that game because as far as the yardage outputs were concerned, I thought the Ravens were moving the ball pretty convincingly on Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh not as much on the other side, and yet Pittsburgh, you know, they get the pick six early in the game. They get some other big turnovers as the game unfolds, and you know, Ben Roethlisberger kept things pretty buttoned up. I know he had some interception issues against Tennessee. Didn't really unfold that way in Baltimore. He played well enough to help seal that victory for Pittsburgh. So what does this Ravens offense need to do to get into gear? I mean, we saw, again, like I was saying with the turnovers, but we also saw like Marquise Brown, you know, tweet out some stuff after the game that was later deleted about kind of unhappy with the usage, with his usage in the offense, that sort of thing. So what's going on here, and can it get better Sunday in Indianapolis?
I'm not really sure. I feel like there are pretty clear possible ways for them to fix it, but I can't tell really what they think the problems are and what they think solutions might be to those problems. Like, I might have different views on both of those questions than they might. And when you don't know what they're thinking, it makes it harder to guess how they might, you know, think in terms of adjustments that they could make. So when I look at the Colts defense, this isn't a defense that uses as much man coverage as some other defenses. Like, Matt Eberflus definitely likes to use zone coverages, and he's good at picking the personnel that execute these zones, and they have very varied personnel in that Colts defense. So they have a bunch of guys. They're kind of like a swarm of players without many stars aside from Darius Leonard and DeForest. And the swarm tends to work pretty well. I just don't know how much the Lamar Jackson offense specifically is the kind of zones or is the kind of offense that those zones are designed in response to? Like, I don't know if they're more like a response to a West Coast offense, a nice classic West Coast offense. Like, maybe that's what Eberflus is more designed to stop than this sort of like postmodern Lamar Jackson, Brian Daboll kind of offense where you do a lot of run fakes anchored at the quarterback with a lot of corner targets from the receivers, vertical targets from the receivers. So on the one hand, I can imagine Eberflus having good ideas about where to put his zones to kind of, I think the Ravens offense has gotten a bit predictable. And if that remains the case here, Eberflus just in general is the kind of guy I think who can come up with some good ideas to sit on it. So if he does, then the Ravens need to turn it into a matter of kind of winning their one-on-one matchups. And I start to think about that scenario specifically, and I think they probably can. It's not like a lock or anything, but I can imagine even if Eberflus gets Xavier Rhodes to sit down in the right spot on this Marquise Brown route, Marquise Brown can just, you know, lose him by a tiny bit and then just kind of run away after that. I don't know. Those corners aren't generally built for receivers like Marquise Brown and Devin Duvernay. They're more built for kind of like kind of receivers. So I feel like Brown and Duvernay especially should be able to get open. Miles Boykin, I can't really imagine does much. He was okay last week, but yes, yeah. I still really think they're hurting themselves by not going to Duvernay. And I don't think Boykin can do anything against Xavier Rhodes. I think that's just like a no-go.
Oh, so that's like the type of corner that specifically sets up to or that would give Boykin the problems.
Yeah, because you don't really see like 6'4 corners, you know. Generally, sure. The biggest a corner gets is a guy like Xavier Rhodes, and the reason is because they need more left to right kind of stop and start kind of ability than a receiver can, because a receiver's they're swerving up the field, you know. They don't have to go all directions. So Rhodes is as big as it gets, basically, and Boykin's as big as and fast as a receiver gets, basically. So I think Rakia Sin, he's a little thinner at least. But even he's like 6 foot or whatever. So I don't really see how Boykin gets on these guys unless they kind of just one of their coverages busts or something.
Yeah. And I've noticed that Boykin's like snap shares and snap counts have been going down a little bit. I know that, again, like he played reasonably well last week, had the touchdown and everything like that. But I think we'll start to see Duvernay creep up and as far as the snap share is concerned, and maybe start to take a little bit more of those left outside reps, that sort of thing. I know that's where most of his like outside reps have gone at Boykin's expense. So we'll see what happens there. As far as this Ravens backfield goes, I think a lot of fantasy managers out there were clamoring, like, you know, send Mark Ingram, you know, far away, like exile him. We need to see the Edwards Dobbins show. And, you know, Ingram, of course, gets hurt against Philadelphia, isn't ready after the bye week. So he sits out, and both Edwards and Dobbins look really, really good against a very, very stout Pittsburgh defense. If Ingram is out again this week, do you think that both Dobbins and Edwards are like start worthy?
It's pretty close. And I'm inclined to say yes, because in Dobbins' case, it's like you can imagine a scenario where the Ravens basically need to abandon the Gus Edwards usage. But in that scenario, Dobbins would probably be involved as a pass catcher. And particularly in the context of this offense needing a new threat, a previously non-existing threat to emerge, that's something that's just screaming for Dobbins, I think, because it's like the opening is there. The usage is up for grabs. It's in limbo. And he's the level of talent where you don't need to come up with some great scheme to get involved. You just need to give him the ball. And he can exploit any part of the defense where they're not taking him seriously. And I think they need to feed him, get him involved more ways until some new pass catching threat emerges, because like the slack is there. It's great when you have a situation where some unexpected slack occurs and you have a talent like Dobbins to turn to. They should just, you know, go head first into that premise, I think. But Gus Edwards as a pure runner is so automatic with the way that this offense structures, because the choice is basically as a defense, like, you let Gus Edwards get 4.5-5 yards a carry, or you let Lamar Jackson turn the corner on you. So you just kind of leave it there, and you might think you're ready to stop Gus Edwards and think like, okay, we simply need to stop the outside, and then we know it's going to Edwards, and so we just got to tackle him. And it's like, this guy's 230 pounds, he is, and he doesn't need to look at where he's going to go the right way on this play. Like, he just hammers it every time. It's a very simple task that he has, and he's very good at it. And it wears on a defense to withstand him. Like, they maybe they stop him a few times. Maybe he doesn't just split the safeties on him. But eventually he can do that too. So it's like it makes everybody better in that offense when they get the defense to kind of key on Gus Edwards a little bit. And Ingram didn't show the ability to cause that sort of damage inside before he got hurt. So I do think keeping them both involved is crucial for the Ravens, especially while Marquise Brown and even Mark Andrews are kind of struggling a bit.
That's basically the only thing that seems to be working right now. I don't know if the passing game will get fixed this year one way or the other, but it does feel like that at least the rushing component should get itself back on track. If it can move Pittsburgh, you can probably move that well against just about anybody. Let's get to the Indianapolis backfield, though, because I think that's like the most, you know, critical fantasy position to talk about when it comes to Indianapolis. I think Phillip Rivers, we've said enough. These pass catchers, really, you know, Phillip Rivers is their quarterback, so that makes it tough. But what do we make of the Jonathan Taylor, Nyheim Hines, Jordan Wilkins situation now?
I'm not really sure. It's kind of interesting that Taylor showed up with an ankle thing on the injury report. It was a really bad outcome last week for Taylor and good for Jordan Wilkins. But it wouldn't surprise me if the ankle had something to do with Taylor sitting out, because he had 11 carries kind of early into the game, and then he didn't get another carry for like a quarter and a half or something. And Wilkins had the same carry count up to that point and then got all of the remaining carries after that. So maybe they were just going to Wilkins because they were like, oh, a hot hand thing. But excuse me, I think other than a 16-yard carry, Wilkins actually had the same yardage count as Taylor up until the 13th carry. So when the difference between the two is a 16-yard carry, it's like, yeah, I think Taylor can get a 16-yard carry. I'm not convinced that Wilkins is better, but I do think Wilkins is pretty good. I think he's just one of those guys who doesn't really project well as a starter or a high usage guy because of his build. Like, he's kind of high. He's almost like a bigger Justin Jackson, I feel like, in that he definitely knows how to run, and he's slick, and his instincts as a runner are really good, but he needs to have those really good instincts because his physical traits aren't ideal. And it's like, specifically, I wish Wilkins was like 20 pounds heavier, or like 3 inches shorter or something like that. But he's really slippery, and he knows how to set up defenders and split them, even if he's not like faster than them or stronger than them. So he won't fail, I don't think, with usage that they give him. And that's a bit of a problem, because it's like, you'd rather have your competition, the fantasy competition, you would rather be a guy who you can bank on stumbling at some point and letting your guy get the next opportunity. But I don't think Wilkins does that. I think he's a good player. So that's concerning for Taylor's sake. The Hines stuff seems to fluctuate wildly from week to week. Like, he's had games like last week, pretty much. I feel like week one he did, actually. And then the next week, they just don't use him. So he can show up. It seems like they kind of have game plan-based decisions that they make before the kickoff, determining his usage, and we're never privy to any of it, so who knows. I don't really like chasing players like that, but if your choices are limited, then I guess it's less of a practical concern then.
Okay, yeah, that's the right way to frame it, because, yeah, there are, you know, he has two games above 20 points on DraftKings this year, and then only one other one north of 10. The rest of them, the other ones, like, are like 7 points or less. So some very, very low floor for him. I guess my like final question. So my last question when it comes to Indianapolis is, you know, with all those factors in mind, with the case you laid out with Jordan Wilkins, plus the fact that the Taylor showed up on the injury report this week, can you feel comfortable starting him against Baltimore?
Well, if Taylor's active and if Wilkins is active, Wilkins seems to be fine, and they both seem fine, I should say. But if they're active, I think, particularly with the injury situation around the league, and we got some bye weeks this week, right? So
yeah,
there's probably you probably have a really good team if you're comfortably putting Jonathan Taylor on the bench. And if you have to put him in your starting lineup, I think you're probably about as well off or better off than most people. So at least given this weird point in time that we're at, I guess that's kind of how I see it.
Okay. All right. That makes sense. Let's move on over. Game of the week, Texans Jaguars, Jake Luton season. What is going on?
Well, I've been wrong about some quarterback stuff lately. I wouldn't say any more than most people. Like, I think I'm still right about quarterbacks more than most people, but like I've been surprised by a few things here or there. Like, for instance, I wouldn't have expected Gardner Minshew to play as much as he has. And even though he's struggled, I wouldn't have even expected him to make it this far. So when I say that Jake Luton might be the worst quarterback prospect that I've ever seen, it doesn't shut down all possibility. Like, there's still that possibility that I just kind of didn't see something that the did. And Luton definitely makes some kind of nice looking throws, and he's, for a tall quarterback, he is pretty flexible. Like, he doesn't look like Drew Bledsoe, even though he's probably the same height and weight as Drew Bledsoe or whatever. He can probably like do it a 2-point stance, for instance, but it's just not that useful that he does these kind of like skills competition pretty throws, because his actual production just wasn't very good. And even last year at Oregon State, which was his fifth year in college after he transferred from Idaho, where he was also insanely bad. And it was only this last year for Luton where he put it all together. And even then, you're talking like low 7 yards per attempt, mid to low 60s completion percentage. Like, he should have been completing 70% of his passes at that experience level, at that yards per attempt. And he, I think, just is one of these guys who just doesn't have the movement speed necessary for the NFL. Like, I think this is the kind of guy who's going to take a lot of hits while he's doing his windup still. And he's Tom Savage comes to mind, I guess. Like, Tom Savage had this amazing inability to just always think the pass rush wasn't there yet, and it was very there. Like, he would be about to get devoured by five different defenders at once, and he's thinking like, this is great. I'm going to make a cool throw in a couple seconds here. And it never happened. And I see Luton getting that too. Like, I can see him taking hits, not even from the blind side, and just get, like, not even seeing it coming, as some guys like zeroed in on him for a good 2 or 3 seconds, going at him like a train. I don't trust him to see the defender in that case. And even if he does, I don't know what he can do about it. He's got a bit of a windup. He's gangly. So he can make these nice looking throws when he's set up, but I think getting a guy like him set up is going to be harder than some coaches expect. So yeah, basically fifth year guy who only in his fifth year was able to become like a slightly above average starter for Oregon State. That's one of those categorical things, anything to do with. And then when you turn on the tape, it's just, I think he's too delicate, basically. Like, he's like a flower who needs a greenhouse to make the quarterback throws, if I may mix the metaphor for a minute. And there's no such greenhouse in the NFL.
No, they're gonna come charging through, and they're gonna muck up your garden.
Bad defense though. Maybe the Texans suck enough for Luton.
Yeah, both these defenses are terrible. So I mean, I guess. But Luton might just be so bad that you know, even Houston can really stop it. I guess what I want to know from, you know, from the downgrade at quarterback, do you have concerns about using DJ Chark, LaVisca Chenault? Okay, if you're concerned about Chark, then I know the answer for the other two. So, yeah, not a great projection as far as those pass catchers go. Do you think they just ride James Robinson really heavy here?
Yeah, and well, you would probably know better than me about Luton at Oregon State. Like, what was his deal when the going got tough? Like, did he check down, or he had a pretty low completion percentage for a low wide? Imagine him being like a throwaway guy, or a guy who chucks it at the sideline, something like that.
Yeah, that was more his speed. Yeah.
Okay, so he was also very play action dependent, is something that I noticed in his tape. So I don't know. I think he sucks, and Robinson they'll definitely stick with. And however much success Robinson can have in spite of Luton, then maybe that will keep the script viable for him to just run all game, and maybe that's the way they keep it going. But if they need Luton to throw like 35 passes, then I can imagine him finishing with like less than 200 yards, even against the Texans.
Yeah, so that's not going to be pretty. On the Texans side of things, they did not get rid of Will Fuller. Smart move by them. What do you make of their offense this week?
Well, maybe a little awkward for them, but the matchup, pretty nice. I guess Henderson might follow around Fuller, might be challenging for Cooks on the applicable routes, but I don't really see that as a big thing. And I feel like Watson should have a defense as bad as the Jaguars, a little bit off rhythm in general. Like, they should – Fells should be open if Fuller isn't. Cook should be open if Fells and Fuller aren't, et cetera. There should always be some way Randall Cobb could have a good game here.
Okay. All right. That all checks out.
David Johnson, is he healthy? I can't remember what his deal is, but a good setup for him.
I've, like, forgotten about David Johnson essentially at this point. I just didn't have any shares of him.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm aware of him, but
you guys, I think he's, well, the listeners can figure this one out. It's not our job.
Coming off the bye. All right. So let's get on over. We got Detroit, Minnesota. Stafford, of course, he's very, very questionable to play with the COVID issue there. Kenny Golladay, of course, got injured this past week, so that's another tough mark, you know, dealing with that hip, listed as doubtful as of Wednesday, so that doesn't bode particularly well for Detroit. They're going up against a Minnesota team that I think had one of the more shocking results of all of last weekend with their ability to go into Green Bay and get the win, and they basically just saw the whole, you know, okay, you guys are conceding the run. Well, let's see how far that, you know, that theory can take you, and just like kind of had Dalvin Cook just gash them over and over again. Does Detroit have that same sort of run defense deficiency to where Minnesota can get away with that similar game script this time around?
Well, I think they should get away with it even if Cook falls to like 4 yards a carry or whatever, just because, I mean, if Stafford's not out there, then this is just a joke of a game. But if Stafford's out there and there's no Golladay, I'm not convinced that Marvin Jones is good enough to really hurt. Like, I think he'll hurt the Vikings corners and that he'll be efficient, but I don't know if he can be efficient in the kind of escalated volume that they'd need to pick up the slack from Golladay missing from the field. And the Detroit run game will be non-viable, I think. Like, Eric Kendricks is too good, in my opinion, to let running backs, especially like with the general nature of the Detroit offense. Like, it'd be one thing if they had a road grading offensive line or something, but DeAndre Swift, maybe in another year, would he be able to stand up to a test like Kendricks? But very few players can play against Kendricks and get the upper hand on him. And with a team as just kind of dysfunctional as the Lions, I feel like it's impossible that they would be the one to do it.
Mm-hmm. That's not a great situation.
So they're going so badly. I think the Lions will go so badly, in other words, that I almost worry about the Vikings ending up in a situation where they're like, you know what, Dalvin, take the last quarter and a half off. Alexander Mattison has this.
Ooh. Well, for the guy that forgot to drop Alexander Mattison, maybe I go back to the well.
You could do a lot worse, I think, with all the goofy stuff going on.
Yeah, honestly, that's how crazy the running back landscape is right now, where even after his dreadful performance when he got the start a few weeks ago, he still might be on the radar. On to this matchup before we move on.
No, it should be a good setup for Kirk Cousins, too. Like, maybe the Vikings give the run game a bit of a day off to try to make Kirk feel good about himself again, because those corners – definitely can't cover Thielen and Jefferson if they want to make it that kind of game.
Yeah, you know it's a bad situation when the Vikings have like a workshop for a regular season game. It's not a great sign for the Detroit Lions. But of course, you know, if you're out Stafford, then there's not a whole lot you can do anyway. Let's get on over. We got the Giants versus the football team. It feels like this is the 14th time that they've played this season. Only the second. Football team 2.5-point favorites in this matchup. I guess football team coming off the bye, the Giants coming off a game where they could have done it against the Bucks, but they did not, of course. What's your read on this matchup?
It's kind of tough because I guess at this point it's safe to say that the Giants defense is better than I thought it would be going into this year. It seems like it's actually a good defense. So if they're a good defense, then I don't think Kyle Allen is good enough to move the ball reliably against them. And if Kyle Allen's kind of mucking things up for the Washington offense, that offensive line obviously can implode like no other and be held up by the rest of the offense. Allen can't do it against a defense like this, so I can see their struggles compounding each other, making it pretty tough on Antonio Gibson to keep his momentum going. But if they give him usage, I think Gibson's one of those guys who's just going to break a 70-yard carry of with enough time. Like, maybe you keep him to 18 yards on the first 15 or something, but size and speed eventually just gets a crack of space, and that's all he really needs. But I don't know if he'll get a chance at that kind of volume, so I'm not exactly optimistic for him this but there's also, on the other side, the chance that you could have a game script where Daniel Jones struggles so much, offense struggles so much against the Washington defense, that maybe Gibson will get that volume and get that chance to eventually make the big play or wear down the defense and start making chunk gains, things like that. So there's a way it could go. I guess it kind of comes down to, like, which quarterback melts down worse than the other. And I have no idea how to call that, because I guess I lean toward Washington having the advantage just because the Giants offensive line is bad too. Whereas even though the Washington offensive line is really bad, the Giants defense is only good in ways that more so threaten the run blocking. Like, it's really tough to run on Dalvin Tomlinson, Leonard Williams, what's the other guy? The Clemson guy. Dexter Lawrence, the huge Clemson guy. Those three guys are all gigantic, and it's tough to move them, and I can imagine there being very little running room as a result, but they're also not likely to collapse the pocket and eat Kyle Allen alive the way Montez Sweat and Chase Young can on the other side. So I guess I lean toward Jones melting down worse, but I don't know. It's like, if he gets time to throw, he has the much better receivers. Like, Sterling Shepard's really good. He's playing at a high level. Darius Slayton, very good. Evan Ingram getting going a little bit, but Jones better get rid of it quick, because I just don't see the Giants offensive line having much of an answer. It's like, they got to use misdirection and catch Washington off guard.
Yeah, because otherwise, yeah, that Washington pass rush is too much. Last time out, it looks like the Giants offense basically only ran 48 plays. Jones went 12 of 19 for a whopping 112 yards, one touchdown, one pick. His day was salvaged by 74 yards on the ground in that one.
55 miles per hour, John. Can you believe that? That's how fast Daniel Jones was on his.
Yes, fun fact. Daniel Jones, fastest man on earth, not just fastest accountant in the world, just fastest man, just ridiculous speed from that guy. Let's get on over to the Bears going up against the Titans. Point favorites in this matchup, coming off a pretty interesting game, whereas the Bears, their game against the Saints was a bit tough to watch, as we've kind of come to expect from the Nick Foles Bears. What do we make of this matchup here?
It's tough because the Bears offense is bad, of course, but so is the Tennessee defense, and I don't even really know why they've been as bad as they've been. Particularly not getting any pressure on Joe Burrow last week was strange, because it seemed like the Bengals try to get him hit. Like, it seems like they go out there and they're like, hey, defense, you want to beat up on this guy for a while? Well, here you go. And the Titans were like, it's a trap, stay back. And he just, you know, not that Burrow tore them apart or whatever, but like, he kind of had a, you know, way different looking game than he normally has. Like, even in his good games in previous cases, like, he gets clobbered all game, and maybe like one or two hits in that one. So I don't know if that was something of a puzzling strategy result for the Titans, or if they just cannot rush the passer at all. And with their corner personnel being compromised, like Adoree Jackson, I don't know when he gets back or whatever, but Chris Jackson, Malcolm Butler, Jonathan Joseph, it's not very good. And Kevin Byard can't keep it all from falling apart at safety. So even with Jayon Brown and Kevin Byard making the middle of the field tougher to throw on, it's like, those guys can't get their coverage assignments done at corner. So those kinds of corners, those kinds of results at cornerback going against Allen Robinson, and with Darnell Mooney looking pretty good. Darnell Mooney, actually, he almost looks like he's like a smaller Stephon Diggs or something like that. Like, he looks really good. And I might think Foles sucks, but do I think that he can't complete passes to Allen Robinson and Anthony Miller and Darnell Mooney against these Titans corners if the Titans aren't even rushing the passer? It's like, I don't know if Foles is that bad. I don't know if there are many NFL quarterbacks that bad. So I can kind of see the Bears making a game of it. And if they can, that's kind of dangerous for the Titans, because like, Derrick Henry should have a good enough game here. But the Bears tend to play – like, their run defense hasn't been good this year, to be clear, but they tend to just kind of show up for a player like that. Like, I don't think this is the days of the Bears defense getting run over or anything like that. I think they can clamp down, especially when their pass defense has been good otherwise, and their pass defense has been good. So maybe they take a little bit off the pass and put it toward the run, and maybe they slow Derrick Henry, and maybe Tannehill is taking these snaps from second and long, and maybe Khalil Mack is coming in and Tannehill starts getting scared like he does, and that's how it can kind of fall apart for the Titans, I think. But if they get Henry rolling, then they keep Tannehill in the setup where he thrives, which is like he kind of needs things teed up for him. And when you tee it up for him, he makes his shot, but he can only take that kind of like sniper shot. Like, he has no in-between game, and he just falls apart when he gets hit a little bit. And when he, you know, Khalil Mack and Akeem Hicks are about as big of a rattle risk as it gets. So I am a little concerned about the Titans. I feel like, you know, they should win, but 6 points, 6.5 points feels like a lot to me, given the range of possible outcomes, I guess.
No, that's a good point. I think not a ton of people do bring it up when it comes to the Titans and their inability to kind of respond on offense when things aren't going absolutely perfectly. It does get pretty clunky there. Like you said, when Tannehill gets a little bit off rhythm, gets uncomfortable back there, then the passing game starts to fold in on itself. And, you know, when like the bread and butter of your offense is like a gigantic running back, you know, eventually a team will just kind of to stop him or force him up the middle, because he does tend to like bounce things outside. So either way, you know, like, things, when things aren't going perfectly for the Titans, they tend to be pretty ugly. And that, again, like you said, is something where the Bears can make this a particularly tough matchup for the Titans, in maybe a way that the spread doesn't imply, or maybe you wouldn't expect just at your initial glance. Let's get on over. We got the Raiders going up against the Chargers. Chargers 1-point favorites at home in this matchup. You know, neither of these teams are going to be facing the weather elements that they were a week ago. So that's obviously a good thing for both of these passing games. You know, ended up being totally wrong about the Raiders because, the wind was so crazy up in Cleveland.
That was a hurricane.
So I'll go ahead and double down on that. I think the Raiders passing game can do well this week, provided that there isn't ridiculous winds within the dome of SoFi Stadium or whatever it is.
Yeah, I'm trying to glance at the injury reports here just to see. I don't know what the latest is with the Raiders and their offense. Oh, wait, they played the game, so they're fine. Okay, all right. So I think if Derek Carr is looking on the field the same way he did against the Chiefs 2 weeks ago, then I actually think he could throw on this Chargers defense. Like, that particular Derek Carr, that version of him, can throw on this Chargers defense, I think, because the way you beat this, the way you fail against this Chargers defense is to play the way Derek Carr normally does. It's to sit on the underneath and intermediate, where Casey Hayward's kind of most comfortable, where Chris Harris, when he's healthy, is most comfortable. And it's letting that pass rush kind of compound your funnel toward that part of the field by not leaving you the choice, by making you get rid of the ball so quick it goes there. And then these corners kind of just sit on those routes and pick on you while you're running into this trap that they've already set up. So the way you beat Hayward, and this has always been the case, but it's especially the case now at his current age, now that he's losing some speed that he couldn't afford to, you want to make him turn and run. You want to make Chris Harris turn and run, and you hit them deep, and then that kind of makes the whole thing fall apart, and then you can start running on them a little bit. But when they're playing that downhill style of defense and you're just playing into it, it's like, that's how you really fail against that defense. Mm-hmm. They just got rid of Desmond King, which seems like it should be a downgrade at the slot corner position. Michael Davis is a good corner, or at least he's getting good results. He's bigger than Hayward and faster than Hayward, so he can run a little bit. But he probably can't run with Henry Ruggs very long, and Hayward definitely can't. So if they get Henry Ruggs going deep in this game, take some shots deep, that's a good way. That's one of the better things they could do, I think. I guess Aguilar could do something too, but I don't think of him specifically as the downfield threat that Ruggs is. To me, it's like Aguilar is a guy who can create separation in the intermediate and underneath and run after the catch, but I don't really want to be sending him on too many fly routes, really. But yeah, between all that and the customary threat posed by Waller, I think there should be a way for the Raiders offense to do better than maybe we would usually expect in a setting like this, which could have pretty big repercussions if that is the case, because then we would have probably a nice big shootout here, because we would probably expect Herbert and the offense to do well against this Raiders defense that's been bad in pretty much every way this year. So I think we can take the Chargers offense for granted. The question is, what kind of response can we expect from the Raiders? And I feel like they might have a better like counter sort of maneuver than we might give them general credit for.
Yeah, no, yeah. People, I mean, obviously, again, last week it didn't go well, but the weather was such a huge factor in that one. But the Raiders' offense, you know, has kind of reshaped itself a bit this year with all the downfield weapons that they have now. People may or may not have caught up to it, but either way, I mean, we got a nice over under here at 52 points. I could see this going well on both sides. This will definitely be one that I'm invested in from DFS perspective a fair bit. I guess one guy, kind of a fringe radar guy to mention when it comes to the Chargers. What are your impressions on Jalen Guyton? Because it seems like, you know, they just send him on like these deep routes. Occasionally he comes down with it for a big play, you know, only has like a barely over a 50% catch rate, but it's been explosive when he's gotten it. So is he someone that, like, if nothing else, like, is he on your Devy or like your dynasty radar or anything like that?
Unfortunately, I would guess he's more likely than not another Robert Foster kind of case. Just if only because it's like these routes that he's been making catches on are so high difficulty. And you know, like you mentioned, he's barely over 50%. It's like, well, running a 23.1 yard average depth of target, you're kind of lucky to even be over 50. It's like the baseline expectation for that is probably like 40% or something. And as much as Guyton might be uniquely good at this one kind of play, he's probably going to be subject to, at the very least, like unfair regression. And that will probably take him toward more of that 40 mark. And it's like he's unpredictably useful right now. He will be more like predictably useless if the number goes toward that baseline, which he's playing above right now. But he can definitely run, and he was a pretty good player at North Texas. It just seems like he doesn't really have like a rounded game. Like he can be good enough if you need him to threaten 2 points on the field, and that's kind of the setup that the Chargers have right now. But I would generally be worried that he's liable to get kind of like displaced by a better prospect in the future. And he would need to go to another team to get the usage escalation, because obviously Keenan Allen, Mike Williams, Hunter Henry, it's like Hunter Henry's really good and he hasn't done that much this year. So that's another way that Guyton could get his cut made even smaller yet.
Okay. All right. Good to know. I mean,
he can burn, though. He can make some plays.
I've been enjoying, you know, his mini surgeons this year. But yeah, I mean, in reality, I think that there's too much working against him, like you said, in the way that he's currently being used. Seems like that's what he's best cut out for, and that just leaves a very, very slim margin for error. We were obviously just talking about one stud rookie quarterback in Justin Herbert. We got one who's still obviously trying to find his way. This is only his second start. Of course, talking about Tua Tagovailoa going up against the Cardinals on the road. Tua struggled in his season debut, or his first start. I think that we both kind of saw that coming with the way that the Rams have played defense this year. That was a really, really tough setup. You know, you got Aaron Donald blowing up the middle of the line, and you got to figure things out after that. And they got all these complex, you know, coverages for the Rams. So that didn't go particularly well for Tua. They didn't need it to, but in this matchup, going up against Kyler Murray and the Cardinals, you know, I think that it might be a little bit more on Tua and the offense to help keep pace in this one. So can he do it against the Cardinals? Because we've seen the Cardinals when they have blood in the water on the other side, you know, the Andy Dalton game against the Cardinals, where they can just blitz and, you know, make things work that way and create havoc that way. Can they do that same thing against Tua?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think the Cardinals, when they had that overtime, those tricks in overtime against the Seahawks, and like that Isaiah Simmons play that was so cool. It's like that stuff that works because you're surprising that quarterback, and it wouldn't have worked a second time. But Tua, it's tough to tell where he's at and his ability to recognize things, because last week was such a disaster. They, like you said, didn't really need to put him out for further exposure, so we don't know how he would have truly responded in a, you know, typically competitive scenario.
I'm kind of optimistic, though, about this setup for him, if only because the Arizona up-tempo detail, and I mean, I guess at least if Kyler Murray and the Arizona offense do well against the Miami defense, then we might have a good setup for Tua. Otherwise, I guess if Murray does struggle against this Miami defense, which is possible, like I don't really feel like the – as much as that Seahawks game was great for the Arizona offense and fantasy, it's like that's, you know, overtime, of course, and then also that long Hopkins touchdown to Quentin Dunbar, like that's one of those plays that's a great play by both Murray and Hopkins, and they can make that play, of course. It's still not the kind of play that you can plan on week to week. And I feel like a play like that, if it hadn't worked, might have had a big change in the outcome, especially if Shaquille Griffin had never gotten hurt for the Seahawks. So I'm a little worried about this improving Miami defense going against Kyler. Like, I can imagine Cliff Kingsbury getting outsmarted here and having no idea that he's at risk of getting outsmarted here. Mm-hmm. And if he gets caught by surprise, I don't trust him to come up with a good idea on the fly. So I'm a little worried for the Arizona offense, I guess. But as long as they're competent, then Tua will have to do more than last week. And as much as the Arizona defense has some good players, I don't think they are good enough to really make Tua look anything like last week in the box score. So I can imagine him throwing like 35 or more passes and looking a lot cleaner than people expected him to. But on the other hand, if Arizona struggles on offense, then I can imagine the Dolphins instead seeing like, hey, maybe let's see if we can get away with the Rams game plan where, you know, we let the defense score 14 points and simply have Tua play caddy to, well, I guess not Miles Gaskin, Jordan Howard, whoever it is. So, yeah, I guess I don't know what to make of that backfield, by the way. Like if Gaskin's out, I don't know, because like the way Howard and Breida played this year didn't look anything like how I understand those players to be. So I thought there was such a disorienting nature to the whole scene that I just can't tell left from right anymore. But I guess it has to be Howard pretty much. Like there's no one else there, or Laird, I guess. Like, I don't know. I'm not putting anything down on it.
No, I mean, it's a total mess. I mean, so they just traded for DeAndre Washington, but Matt Breida did not practice on Thursday. Jordan Howard is basically the only guy with any sort of, you know, NFL reputation or accomplishments that's
Laird could be a passing down thing, I guess, but it's like we don't know how many pass plays they're going to run.
Oh, that's a good point too. So there's that is a mess of a backfield. So yes. So yeah, Miami might just need to win with their defense again. I'm not sure that they'll be able to do that.
Real quickly, the Dolphins traded Isaiah Ford, and Mike Gesicki is going to play a lot of slot receiver. He always does. But I almost wonder if it's worth picking up in deeper leagues or making a tournament lineup with Jakeem Grant.
Let's go. Okay, I'm always listening. Because
they might be looking to give him a promotion. Like he had the punt return for a touchdown. He's been pretty good as a pass catcher the past month, but it's either they have to give Jakeem Grant more snaps or they have to give Lynn Bowden more snaps, and it could be either one. I guess it could be both in some sense, but Grant's at least a guy who he's getting a little bit of air yardage right now, and he's a big yards after the catch guy. So if he starts getting completions, he's going to start doing things after the catch, and he gets carries now and then. So there might be something there. I don't know.
I love it. Yeah, Jakeem Grant is such a fun player dating back to his Texas Tech days. So I think he's earned that promotion to at least get a look.
Earned the chance to fail at the very least. Like he has to fail before they, you know, put him back in the basement, I think.
Mm-hmm. Let's get on over. We got, you know, just a classic matchup between two of the great NFL franchises. Truly one of the grosser games on the slate, though. I'm sorry. Steelers going up against the Cowboys. Steelers, obviously, you know, one of the best teams in the NFL. That defense, that pass rush specifically, is crazy. The Cowboys are just an absolute disaster right now. I believe that Cooper Rush is going to be starting this game. So that's just I don't even know what to say further about this game. Like you can just say that Cooper Rush is starting and just kind of like leave it at that almost. But I mean, do you have anything to really dive in on when it comes to this matchup?
Well, I don't know what the Steelers are looking at it like, but I could imagine them going into this game and seeing it as a tune-up opportunity for Ben Roethlisberger because the Cowboys defense is so bad against the pass, of course, and Roethlisberger has not been able to get going this year. Like he's just constantly barely escaping, you know, these traps, these Indiana Jones scenarios on the football field where he's, you know, making a 3-yard shovel, barely escape the buzzsaw that's coming for his face. And it's just, I don't know how long they can keep doing that and be competitive to the level that they aspire to. So they have to get Roethlisberger playing better, and maybe they look at this kind of like an exhibition game for him against this non-existent Dallas pass defense, and one where Roethlisberger can kind of like get into a rhythm and pile up some numbers, and then, you know, basically give them a heavy dose of Benny Snell and Anthony McFarland in the second half when they go in with like a 28-0 box score or something, scoreboard, I should say. So I can see any number of Pittsburgh pass catchers getting going. I think it'll just kind of be a matter of like which one Roethlisberger looks at first on a play, because everybody's probably going to be open. So Deontay Johnson, Chase Claypool, Juju, any of the Eric Ebron, it's all on the table, I think. And it's just like how big of a pie is there to go around kind of thing. So I expect Roethlisberger to have a big game. Connor could have a big game. And if Roethlisberger doesn't have a big game, then Connor almost necessarily will. I could just, again, see them throwing. I could see them like throwing the ball 15 times in the first 18 snaps just to make it like the Ben Roethlisberger show. And make everyone see how normal his elbow is. See how okay
right,
he is.
Yeah, he was like rubbing it the entire game on the sideline last week. But no, nothing's wrong.
Well, maybe if it is really wrong, then maybe they'll have to hide him. But that offense can't win a Super Bowl right now. I know that.
Okay, that's huge. When it comes to Juju Smith-Schuster, though, I mean, he's kind of left for dead after the first 6 weeks of the season, not getting a ton of targets, not really doing much with his targets. But the last 2 weeks, he's seen 22 targets and he's, you know, caught 16 of them for, you know, a pretty decent clip. So is there a chance that his season gets salvaged, not to the point where, you know, he really returns on whatever the mid third round investment that you made, but someone that you can feel comfortable starting down the stretch?
Well, I think you can feel comfortable starting him, but part of that is just kind of the perspective of being resigned to the fact that you can't do any better than him. It's like that better fantasy options than Juju Smith-Schuster aren't just available in most leagues. So I don't think there's much actionable to be done about it. It's like we just have to readjust expectations. And I think that the Steelers are largely banking on a spread out field to offset Roethlisberger's inability to throw downfield. And they hope that, you know, the safeties creep up perhaps, but we make the field wider horizontally and create new windows for him to throw to. And that's basically what they've been doing. And it's basically been working, but it's not a setup that favors Juju, because he becomes kind of like the roof of the house that protects these other routes, which are being run by Claypool and Johnson underneath, because they can't go above that point. They always have to play underneath whoever is kind of like setting the roof in this analogy. And it's always going to be Juju, because the defenses respect him more than certainly Deontay Johnson. And Claypool, just because he's so big and fast, you have to give a different kind of attention to, even if you're not specifically respecting him as a threat. But Juju's getting attention in the middle of the field that leaves Johnson in these one-on-one situations where the defense doesn't put a second guy on him because they know he can't run after the catch away for a big play. So they're like, just leave the corner on him. We'll focus on Juju. Watch out for that fast, tall guy over there. And Deontay Johnson keeps getting these basically just screen passes. They're glorified screen passes from Ben Roethlisberger, and he keeps getting open on them because he does these little like head fake things that get him open for a quick bit at a time here and there. And he's effective in that capacity, and it's not useful for the overall offense to be like competitive in an overall healthy sense. But when the defense is as good as Pittsburgh's is, it doesn't matter. Like, they're moving the chains, and that's all that they really need to do, because the other team isn't even getting field goals. So that's the way it's been going. And until defenses crash on Deontay Johnson, or until they start conceiving the offense differently, I worry that Juju's always going to be that lightning rod at the top. And because I just can't see a defense caring more about Deontay Johnson. And I feel like Roethlisberger either needs to improve and start throwing more downfield, or Deontay Johnson needs to get demoted for Juju to have the runway that he's accustomed to.
Yeah, looking at the entire NFL and players that 40 targets. So that includes receivers, tight ends, and running backs. Deontay Johnson, the only receiver with a sub 5.4 yards per target right now. So, I mean, he's right there with Evan Ingram, Logan Thomas, Jimmy Graham, Zeke, and Zach Ertz, rounding out like the bottom of the list as far as yards per target. So, yeah, like, it, you know, he's catching a lot, but at the same time, like, it's very, very empty results as far as like the returns on his receptions are concerned a lot of the time. Let's keep it rolling. Or I guess we got to know, with the Cowboys, I mean, you have guys like Amari Cooper, CeeDee Lamb, Michael Gallup. Like, do you have to bench those guys this week?
I wouldn't argue against it. I mean, if Amari Cooper could only get one catch last week, then what's...
Yeah.
It's not going to get better. I mean, I do. To be clear, Cooper Rush is definitely better than DiNucci. It was so funny how bad DiNucci was, but that's basically McCarthy just being a moron and putting his thumb on the scale, because Cooper Rush wouldn't lose a fair competition to DiNucci. DiNucci, we all saw it. That guy should never have been anywhere near the NFL. Apparently, I'm choosing to say it's all because of that stupid little story about how, like, Mike's brother coached Ben DiNucci on Little League baseball in fifth grade. And I actually am willing to believe that McCarthy is a dumb enough guy that that was the entire reason that he's on the team.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, wait, that does check out. Like, McCarthy, Pittsburgh guy. I think DiNucci got his college start at Pitt.
That's right.
Before going down to James Madison. So honestly, yeah, that adds up. You know,
Cooper Rush, you were on the wrong Little League team, my friend.
Yeah.
Or yeah, I mean, together. I guess, you know, starting against the Steelers and the Eagles isn't an enviable position, but that is the reason Rush didn't start last week.
Pretty tough times in Dallas.
Stupid
right
team.
Now.
Love it.
Very, very dumb. All right, we got a couple more games to get to as we round things out. Sunday nighter, Saints Bucks should be a pretty good one. I think we're going to see Michael Thomas back in the fold. Can that pick up the Saints offense going up against, you know, what has kind of turned into a buzzsaw of a defense for the Bucks?
I don't really see it. I mean, Drew Brees, to his credit, has played well, but he's also played well to the point that I don't even think Michael Thomas is very good. It was a concession for people like me to say Michael Thomas was even like a top five NFL receiver. And now I'm back on like, nah, he's like wide receiver 12 or something. This is stupid. They make Marquez Callaway Michael Thomas numbers. Emmanuel Sanders puts up Michael Thomas numbers. Traquan Smith puts up Michael Thomas numbers. It's a system. It's Drew Brees. I don't care. So I think on the other hand, Tampa has real firepower, even if Godwin's out. It's like Evans against Lattimore. Lattimore's not playing well this year. Evans has the upper hand there. Antonio Brown, I don't particularly care about, but whatever. He has the advantage. Miller has the advantage. Gronk's getting going a little bit. I don't think the Saints cover this. Like, I don't know. Maybe I'm getting too hopped up on Buccaneers hype, but I just think they have a big personnel advantage here, and I don't think Michael Thomas matters very much.
I think you're right. I think that I think you have it nailed as far as the product of the system when it came to Thomas's numbers. He was amazing at what he did, but his function, it can be replaced because he's not doing the most high difficulty things in the world. He's basically just catching the ball. That's the extent of it. On the Bucs side, you know, they are just rolling. I know they might have got caught looking ahead this past week in New York. I don't really see that happening again. Of course, this is a big matchup for them. They need to, you know, even the score with the Saints as far as the season series is concerned. So I like the Bucs here. I like them at better than -4 as well, too. So I think you have that one right. Let's round things out here. We got the Patriots going up against the Jets, a game that I'm sure the NFL wishes it could flex, but it's a Monday night game, so we got it. Sell us on watching this game.
I'd have to threaten you, I guess. Like, that's what it would take, right?
Yeah, like, honestly. Like,
either
bribery or
game.
Threat.
Yeah. So short of that, I don't really know what to tell you. I wouldn't watch it. I predict that I won't watch it. And I don't know. I guess I kind of like the Patriots to cover because I just there's something special going on with the Jets, you know, like this is the worst team ever. And I just don't know. I can't see the Patriots even in their kind of like ashamed current state, I don't think they're capable of not blowing them out.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, this comes down to like the age old, you know, Belichick with a team of backups, could he beat the worst team in football? So we really get the answer to that this time, and I think he will. I think he will beat them soundly, comfortably. I think the Jets will kind of help the Patriots' cause in this one. I think that they just are so mistake prone, so disjointed as a team that, you know, they'll make some mistakes to really help things set up well for the Patriots. So yeah, this will go down as like one of the most ridiculous Monday night games in recent memory. Really, really looking forward to it, of course. Anything else to add on here before we round things out?
No, I hope we don't have a ridiculous COVID situation on Monday.
Yes, that would That's be, all. Yeah, you know, we need to, no comment on that. It needs to get under
Fingers
wraps.
Crossed.
Fingers crossed. But otherwise, that'll do it for us here on the Thursday RotoWire NFL podcast. Thanks to our sponsors, PropSwap and BetMGM. Big thanks to you, Mario. And make sure you listen to the Friday show, Scott Genstad, Andrew Laird, DFS. It's a must listen. But again, thanks again for checking out RotoWire on the Thursday show.